You know what time it is. It's time for Ask a Spaceman. I'm your host, Paul Sutter. You've got questions, and I've got the answers. Pretty simple idea. You know how the show works, but I'm going to let you know anyway, because maybe it's been a while, you know? All right, so you go online to Twitter or Facebook, use the hashtag Ask a Spaceman. Do what the hashtag suggests and ask a spaceman. You can also send me questions directly on Facebook and Twitter. You can find me at Paul Matt Sutter, because that's my name. Kind of weird if I were to use someone else's name. That'd be a little bit complicated. So I used my own. I used my own name for my Twitter handle. Seemed to make sense. You can also go to askaspaceman.com. And we have a very simple goal with this show. Very straightforward. Complete knowledge of time and space. It'll take a while, but I don't plan on going anywhere anytime soon. So don't you worry. Now, on that road to complete knowledge of time and space, we have a bunch of questions. I've been getting questions the past few months, especially with like the news of exoplanets in general, and some specific questions like John Ziegler on Facebook. He asked, he started out just saying, exoplanets, exclamation point. I feel the same way. Just everyone say it. Exoplanets. That's so much fun. His actual question was, how reliable are the measurements? And what's up with orbital migration and hot Jupiters? Dan Cataldo on email, he was also curious about planetary migration, asking how it works. At Infirmus on Twitter said, has Kepler, this is one of the planet hunting missions that we have, been giving us false positives when it comes to exoplanet detection? Mark on Twitter at Mark Reap asked, of all the exoplanets discovered, how many correspond to the planets around our own sun? Like, how weird are they? How not weird are they? And finally, Kieran Price on Facebook asked, if we discovered an Earth-like exoplanet, could we send a probe to it? There are just so many questions about exoplanets, so much interest in exoplanets. And what gets me, what's really crazy is 20, 30 years ago, there were no exoplanets. There were just planets. There were just planets in our own solar system. And then starting around the early 90s, we started having a few. All through the 90s, we had maybe like a handful or a dozen. Really hard to detect, really tough to pin down. We had a feeling that they were out there, but like, you know, just the measurements, just the technology needed to get a detection of an exoplanet was just so hard. These are very precise measurements. And I'll talk about the methods we use to get exoplanets in a little bit. But just the technology just had to be there. You just couldn't do this with like turn of the 20th century technology. You couldn't do it with photographic plates or really long telescopes. It just had to have a certain kind of technical expertise in order to get at these planets. And finally, after the turn of the 21st century, we launched some satellites. We had some breakthroughs in ground-based observing. And instead of just having zero or a dozen or a few planets, we have hundreds and then thousands. In fact, now we have over 2,000 planets confirmed. Planets outside of our solar system confirmed. We've measured their properties. And the kinds of planets we're discovering are ridiculous. It's just straight up, capital, all the letters in the word ridiculous, ridiculous. It's like a science fiction movie. You know, when you see Star Wars or Star Trek, they're always visiting new worlds and every planet's different than the last. It always has some strange feature, some strange quirk about it. And you know what? That's pretty much how planets in our galaxy are. Our 2,000 planets that we've found are all over the map. We have ones that are bigger than Jupiter. We have ones that are smaller than Mercury. We even know of exoplanets that are about the size of our moon. And that's tiny. When it comes to planets, that's like nothing. All right, that's like BBs or something. We've got planets that are closer to their parent star than the orbit of Mercury and farther from their parent star than the orbit of Neptune. We have planets around young stars. We have planets around middle-aged stars. We have planets around big giant stars and little stars and sun-like stars. We have planets around red dwarfs. We have planets around pulsars. We have planets around binaries. We have planets around trinaries. We have planets around one member of a binary. We have planets around both members of a binary. It's like every possible combination you could possibly think of planet and star combo. It's up on the board. It's up for grabs. We've already spotted in our limited survey, we've already spotted a planet like that. And the planets that we're seeing are just mind-blowing. We've got planets that are deep blue. We've got planets that are purple. We have planets that reflect less than 1% of the light from their parent star, which means they're blacker than coal. We have planets with rings. We have planets with comet tails as they're being obliterated from being too close to their sun. We have planets with magnetic fields. We have planets with moons. Did I mention the rings? We might have planets with rings. And not just gas giant planets, we might have rocky planets with rings. That's what's going on in our own galaxy. Those 2,000 planets span such a wide variety. It is astounding. Have I used the word ridiculous yet? Yes, I have, and I'm going to use it again. It is ridiculous, the amount and the variety of planets that we're seeing. We might even have a detection of rogue planets. What in the world? I can't just... Sorry, I'm getting a little bit excited. Can you tell? Can you tell I'm getting excited? Here we go again. It's ridiculous. All right, the rogue planets, either kicked out of their own solar system, or they kind of formed independently the same way stars and planetary systems form. Maybe there just isn't enough juice to get a star going, so they just form a dinky little planet. When it comes to extrasolar planets or these exoplanets, we have vastly underestimated the number of planets in our own galaxy. You know, if you were to rewind the clock like 30, 40 years and ask a random astronomer, astrophysicist, how many planets there are, it was generally thought that there just wouldn't be a lot of planets, that planets would be generally rare. You'd either have stars with maybe a few planets, stars by themselves, or binary triple systems, which would be far more common. And that planets, yeah, they might be here and there. But basically, if you want a rough idea of how many planets there are in the galaxy, count the stars. And for about every star, there'll be a planet. Now, some stars may not have any planet, but some stars will have a bunch of planets, and so it evens out. If you've got 300 billion stars in a galaxy, you have around 300 billion planets in orbit around those stars in some configuration, plus all the rogue planets where there may be up to a trillion rogue planets. I'm not making this up. These are real numbers, good solid estimates based on the surveys we've already done of the number of planets in our galaxy. We're swimming in planets. The galaxy is lousy with planets and infested with planets. If you just wanted to restrict yourself to Earth-like planets around sun-like stars, and here Earth-like means, you know, the usual definition of Earth-like is anywhere between a quarter of the mass of the Earth and four times the mass of the Earth. I don't know why they chose those boundaries, but they did. And if you restrict yourself to that and just look at stars like our own sun, so the same age, same kind of star, I know I haven't talked about kinds of stars before. Feel free to ask the question, by the way. If you just restrict yourself to that very narrow subset of what kinds of planets would be most like Earth and how many are those of those in the galaxy, you've got somewhere around 11 billion. Classic Sagan, billion with a B, 11 billion Earth-like planets around sun-like stars in our own galaxy alone, not even counting all the other galaxies in the observable universe. So add a few more B's to that billion to get the total number. And if you're asking like how many, like say Jupiters, or how many Neptunes, how many Mercuries, how many Marses, every planet in our own solar system is represented in the survey of exoplanets that we have, and more. And more. So like I said, like our solar system doesn't even represent the full variety of planets that are available in other stars, around other stars. Some are so big. Some planets get so big. I should have mentioned this earlier. Some planets get so big, they're right on the boundary between planet, brown dwarf, failed star. We're not exactly sure how massive a planet can get before fusion ignites in the core. You can say it's somewhere like, 10 or 20 times the mass of Jupiter, but if there's a solid core that kind of throws a monkey wrench into your nuclear plans. So we're not exactly sure, but there are some big fat planets that might even be larger than the smallest stars. I mean, that boundary is super fuzzy, but it's because of our surveys of the exoplanets that we're beginning to figure out what that boundary is. Like in our own solar system, Jupiter is nowhere near being a star, but other solar systems have planets that threaten, that rival their parent star. And most of the Jupiter-like planets, the big ones that we've found, tend to be in like normal orbits, quote unquote normal. So like if you plop them down in the solar system, our own solar system, they wouldn't exactly be out of place. They might be a little bit closer, maybe a little bit farther, but you'd recognize them as like, oh yeah, that's where a giant planet ought to go. But some are really, 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 really close is a good way to put it, to their parent star. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. And we've detected a lot of these really big fat planets, these planets bigger than Jupiter, because our detection methods, which don't worry, I'm still working my way up to the detection methods. They are a little bit biased towards big planets and planets close to their parent star. And biased, it's just like, let's say you walked into a new city. You just dropped yourself down in a new city and you wanted to see what kind of food people ate in that city. So, you know what to eat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And you picked one person at random and you said, I'm going to follow this person around. I'm going to eat whatever they eat. But what if that person you picked just happened to love spicy food and wanted to eat spicy food, was in the mood for spicy food for every meal? And breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you copied whatever they ordered off the menu, you'd order off the menu. And you did this for a week and all they ate was spicy food. You would think that the only thing available in that city was spicy food, right? Because you have a biased sample. Your little measurement technique for picking out the kind of food in a new city favors spicy food because the person you're following just happened to like spicy food. So that's a biased measurement, and our detection methods tend to be a little bit biased. They tend to pick out the bigger planets, the planets that are closer, easier than they pick out the small planets or the planets that are far away. And that's just life, and we're kind of dealing with it. We're working around it, and I'll get to it in a little bit. But before I do, I want to talk about the potential Earth-like planets a little bit more. Because this is like what's driving our exoplanet research is we want to find Earth version 2.0, right? We want to find an Earth-like planet in the habitable zone of its star. And again, and I've talked about this before a little bit. Habitable zone is the place where water doesn't freeze, so you're not too far away from the parent star. And then it's not too close that all the water actually boils off. And it's different for every star and every configuration of stars. So like binary star systems will have a different habitable zone than solitary star systems. And depending on the brightness or the age, the habitable zone will shift around in the solar system wherever it is. The Earth is in the habitable zone of our own sun. Hence, we inhabit it. And if we're looking for Earth-like planets, we want to say, hey, where's the best chances of finding something a lot like us? Well, the best place to look will be in sun-like stars, Earth-like planets, with Earth-like orbits and characteristics. So it's kind of like two criteria at the same time that you have to satisfy. You need an Earth-like planet, you need a planet a lot like the Earth, and it needs to be in the right orbit around the star. The closest candidate is a little planet called Tau Ceti E. It's about 12 light years away. It's in the habitable zone of its parent star. Its star is a lot like our own sun. It's more massive than the Earth. It's about 4 times the mass of the Earth, and it's not yet confirmed. We just have a barest glimmer of detection. We need some more follow-up observations to really pin it down. But that's just the closest. All told, we have 20 to 30, depending on how you want to count it, depending on how you want to count how confirmed they are, your level of confidence that we really are detecting a planet there. We have 20 to 30 Earth-ish planets. Most of them are super Earths, or multiple times the mass of the Earth. And even the ones that are called Earth-like, when there's a new press release, NASA announces the discovery of an Earth-like planet, usually it's a few times the mass of the Earth, but usually around the same size, which means they're actually rather dense, which is interesting. Why? I don't know. It just seems interesting, okay? So you may have heard last year Kepler 452b, it made a big splash in the news. It's in the habitable zone of its planet. It's 60% wider than the Earth, but it is 5 times more massive and probably rocky because it's hard to have a gas giant not be giant. You just call them gas littles? I don't know. We don't really have a name for that because it doesn't tend to happen in nature. If you're gassy, you're already giant. And if you're not gassy, you're probably going to be a rocky planet. But again, and so it's not exactly habitable. I wouldn't want to visit Kepler 452b because I would be squished like a bug under my shoe because of all the strong gravity. So there you go. And this underscores a little comment I need to make. The importance of modeling. The importance of doing... we have a limited amount of data when we're looking at these planets. Some of them we have a lot of information about, and don't worry, I will get there. Just settle down, be patient. This is a half hour long show, got plenty of time. Anyway, most of the planets we just have only a little bits of information, like their size, their mass, and their distance from the star. And so we have to make an educated guess about the properties of the planet, with the exceptions where we have lots of information. But in most cases, we just have to say, if this planet is this massive at this distance from its parent star, it probably can't be a gas giant because the gas would have boiled away or something, or based on its composition that we know about, based on the metallicity of its parent star. You put little bits of information to try to develop this whole picture. It is far from complete. Exoplanets are a new area of research, an active area of research. There's a lot of things we don't understand about exoplanets. So everything you need, not a grain of salt when you hear a new result, but we're still working on the problem. We figured out a lot in our modeling, in our theoretical understanding of how planets form and planetary compositions can get us pretty far. There's still some holes in the picture. We do know about Earth-like planets, so Earth-size, Earth-mass planets, but they tend to be around red dwarfs, or the ones we found are around red dwarfs. So small, long-lived stars. Maybe there's a habitable zone, but they tend to be a little erratic. Every once in a while, they're a little angry, so red angry dwarfs. They'll spit out big blobs of plasma way more active than our own sun is, so probably not the most conducive conditions for finding life. So finally, I've been teasing this for 15 minutes or whatever. How do we actually find these planets, and how reliable are the methods? The answer is There are many different methods, and they all have their kind of shortcomings and strengths, but usually we try to work them together. So a planet might be detected with one method, and it gets listed as a candidate, and then another telescope that maybe needs to take longer observations will pinpoint on that candidate, try to get more information, and then it moves from the candidate column into the confirmed column, and we start to learn more about that planet. So one method is called the radial velocity method, and you know how planets orbit stars. That's kind of the definition. Okay, we can go with that. But as the planet, as any planet orbits its star, it makes the star wobble. Because if the planet's, because gravity is a two-way thing, right? I'm attracted to the Earth, and the Earth is attracted to me. It's mutual. Reciprocated attraction. Isn't that beautiful? We pull on each other. Gravity works in both ways. So as much as the Earth pulls on me, I pull on the Earth. Now, the Earth is a tiny bit bigger than me, not as much ever since Thanksgiving dinner, but it's still a lot bigger than me. And so it pulls on me more than I pull on it. But when you have a planet, planets are usually much, much smaller than their parent stars. But when they're over here, say on one side of the solar system, the sun or the star gets pulled in that direction just a little bit. It's like, hey, I want to go over there. I want to go meet you. And then half an orbit later, when that planet's on the opposite side of the system, that star is like, oh, wait, no, you're over there. Now I want to come over there. I want to go over there. Yeah, and so it tries to chase after it, and then back and forth. It sloshes around a little bit. And the bigger the planet, and the closer it is, the more it will slosh. And so what we can do is we can stare at the light from a star. And as it's wobbling, we don't look for the side-to-side wobble. We look for the back-and-forth wobble. So sometimes the planet will be on our side of the star, and sometimes it will be on the opposite. And it makes that star wobble back and forth, or maybe to and fro, and sometimes fro and to. And when it does that, the light from the star gets blue shifted and red shifted, just like an ambulance coming up to you. The sound waves get blue shifted, and then when it goes away, it goes red shifted. The tone or the pitch changes. The pitch, quote unquote, of the light can change depending on the motion of the moving body. That's probably a whole other podcast just to describe the implications of redshift and blue shift in our observations of distant stuff. But you get the idea. The star wobbles, the light shifts a little bit. We can look for it. Radial velocity methods. Good. Like I said, this is a biased method, or it's easier to pick out bigger planets that are closer to their parent stars, because then you'll get a nice big fat wobble that's easy to detect. The second method, and the most common method, how we find most of the planets nowadays, is what's called a transit method. Transit method is if that planet comes between us and the star. So if you get that lucky alignment where it just happens to come between us and the star, that planet will block a little bit of the light, just like an eclipse, except like really, really tiny. You don't actually see the planet, but if you're just staring at the light of the star, you got your eyes wide open or your telescope wide open, you're staring at that star, that planet, and when it's coming around its orbit, it will first cross in front of the star, so the brightness will come down just a tiny bit, just a little bit, because the planet's really tiny. And it'll cross the face of the star, and so that brightness will be down while that planet's doing its orbit thing in front of the star, and then it'll go away from the face of the star from our point of view, and then the brightness will go back up. And that's it. So you just stare at a star and you look for those dips. Now, it's a little more complicated than that, because sometimes stars have variable brightness. They'll wiggle around a little bit. Sometimes stars have binary companions aren't necessarily planets. They're maybe just dim companion stars that will also cause a dip in the brightness. So that's where we get lots of our candidate planets. We have a mission called Kepler that has somewhere around 5,000, I think, candidate planets. based on these little dips in the light, the brightness coming from individual stars, and they need follow-ups to really confirm, to double check that it's, you know, not just an accident, the star's not just being weird, or it really is a planet and not like a little binary star that we've never noticed before. We also need to get lucky, so we won't be able to capture every planet around every kind of star, only the ones where the alignment is just right. And it turns out there's so many stinking planets out there that this happens all the time, and we can get thousands of planets. Isn't that awesome? Another cool thing about the transit method, I mentioned before how most of the time we only get a little bit of information about the planet. Sometimes we get a lot, and we get a lot through this transit method, because as that planet is blocking a little bit of light from the star, some of that light will bounce off the planet. Some of that light will pass through the planet's atmosphere, and we see that affected light. We get to see it because it's in the way of us in the starlight, and we already know what the star looks like when the planet's not there, and then we can compare it to what the starlight looks like with the planet there, and we can figure out what the planet is made of. Isn't that awesome? I don't know about you, but I do know about me sometimes. And in this case, I do know for sure that that is just mind-blowing. We are studying, in some limited cases, we're studying the atmospheres of planets around different stars. We are figuring out what the atmospheres are made of and the densities and the properties of those planetary atmospheres and the surfaces of the planets themselves. That's how we know about the deep blue planet, the magenta planet, the coal black planet. We know about through this method. That's awesome. Like, just yay science, okay? Now, another method, timing variations. So if you're looking at a star that's pulsating, a pulsating star, aka a pulsar, and it's going womp, 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 womp. As the planet's doing its orbit, it will make the star wobble a bit, just like before, and it will affect that timing of the womp, 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 womp. And if the timing is regular enough, and in pulsars, they are insanely regular. That's like a whole other show right there. I talked about them a little bit when I talked about magnetars, but I should dig into pulsars more. So someone please ask the question. They're going womp, 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 womp. The planets, or sometimes multiple planets, affect the womp, 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 womp. And you can figure it out. You can math it out that there's a planet there. In fact, this is how we discovered the very first planet outside of our own solar system, was with this method. It's super hard though, so there's only like five or whatever planets known through this method. There's a few other methods like microlensing, where you're looking at the path of light from background stars or background galaxies being bent gravitationally as it passes near a star, and then you be as the planet is orbiting, it affects that signal. And then, you know what? We have good old-fashioned pictures. That's right. We have pictures of planets around other stars. Pictures. And what we do is take a teeny little dot and we block out the light from the star, just like you might like block out, hold up your hand or something to block out the light of the sun so you can see something else on the sky. You can block out the light from a star. Bink, like just hold your thumbnail out really, really, really far and you'll block out the light from that star and you'll be able to see the planets around that. Usually what we do is we switch to infrared, because if you've got a nice, hot, warm planet, it'll be glowing in infrared, where the star won't be so bright in infrared. So it's best for big planets that are young and hot and tend to be farther away from their parent star. But you know what? We've got some pictures. We have more pictures of planets around other stars than we do of Bigfoot. Boom. So we have all these methods, many more, and a few other methods. By far the most common is transit, gives us lots of candidate planets, and then they're followed up. Multiple observatories around the world, some in space, multiple teams, sometimes competing, sometimes collaborating, all trying to get as many planets as possible and fill out that catalog, map out. And already we've gotten 2,000, and really we've just started getting going. We haven't really played this game a lot. All right, so I talked at the beginning about how crazy and ridiculous, redonkulous, these planets are, some of these planets, and especially the Jupiters, the planets that are bigger than Jupiter that are very, very close to the star. These are interesting because before we started doing these planet surveys, we thought we had it all figured out, of course. We thought we knew where planets would be. We thought we knew, like, okay, rocky planets close to a star, gas giants on the outskirts, end of story. If you can't figure it out, that's the sound of me wiping my hands together like I just did a job well done. Well, surprise! There are some planets bigger than the size of Jupiter orbiting closer than the orbit of Mercury. Some even have orbits of less than a day. An Earth day. 24 hours. Imagine a planet 5-10 times the size of Jupiter, so close to its parent star, orbiting rapidly, orbiting once around its star in less than 24 hours. Just what is that? Just, I can't believe it. Like no one would have guessed that. No one would have said, if you asked someone like 50 years ago, hey, old timer astronomer, where do you expect giant planets to form? Nobody would have said right next to the star. Nobody. And it's just, here we go, ridiculous. Again, that's going to be the theme of the episode. I should just call it, what's up with ridiculous exoplanets? Actually, that's a great idea for a title. Man, it's too late to change my chalkboard. For those of you, I record these on YouTube. If you're just listening to audio, you can go to YouTube, Ask a Spaceman, and I write the title of the episode on my chalkboard, but it's way too late. It just says, what does it say? What's up with exoplanets? Not ridiculous exoplanets. I don't know. Maybe I can CGI that later. Anyway, the big question is, how in the world do these massive Jupiters get there? Because there's not enough stuff close to a young star to make it actually form there. Because you don't just need gas to make a gas giant. You need to start with a pretty hefty core. And the core can't just be rocks. It has to also be ices. That way you get a big enough core that can start sucking out and make a big giant gas envelope. So how do they get there? And the idea is something called planetary migration. And I thought when I first put together this episode that like I could talk about a whole bunch of other stuff and then spend like 5 minutes or whatever on planetary migration. I was kind of wrong. It turns out planetary migration is an incredibly tricky and intricate concept. I'm going to give you a little bit now, but let's face it, we're going to have to do a whole other episode just straight up. What is planetary migration? How do planets move around? Kind of complicated. Here's like the tiny version that allows me to barely, you know, qualify as answering the question for the purposes of this episode. So our best guess of what's happening with these hot Jupiters, that's what they're called, by the way, is these massive multiple size of Jupiter orbiting so close. They're close. They're hot. Hot Jupiter sounds kind of cool. So the name stuck. Hot Jupiter. How do hot Jupiters form? We think they start out as normal Jupiters, kind of far away, because that's where you can have enough stuff to make a giant planet. It'll clear a gap in the disk. So there's a young protoplanetary disk. It hasn't settled down to be planets yet. We've got a young protostar in the center, not quite fusion ignition yet. One of these massive planets forms, clears a gap in that disk, eats up all the gas and spits out all the rest so that there's this young planet sitting in the middle of this rather wide gap in the disk. And it can't move away from the middle of the gap, because if the planet just happened to wander closer, the stuff inside of the gap, on the inside edge of the gap, is moving faster than it, so it will like speed it up. And then the stuff on the outside edge of the gap is moving slower than the planet. So if the planet tries to wander out further, it gets slowed down, and so it will always tend to stick in the middle of this gap. But since this process happens rather early in the evolution of a solar system, the entire disk of gas, this baby solar system that's still forming, is compressing, is getting smaller and tighter and more compact. And so this gap gets carried along with the compression of the disk. So that planet forms pretty far out, but it gets kind of carried along as that disk compresses and as the solar system starts to actually get its stuff together. And that's how we think hot Jupiters form? Maybe? Question mark? Several question marks? I mean, there's some obvious questions. Like, if this is so easy, it sounds like every gas giant ought to do this. Why do only some of gas giants do this? Why didn't Jupiter do this? What makes it kind of stop? Because gas falls all the way down until it reaches the star. But these hot Jupiters didn't hit the star. They stopped really close, but not all the way. So what made him stop? And this whole gas, gap forming thing may seem a little bit fishy. Anyway, there's just lots of questions surrounding this problem, and it is an open research question. We don't fully understand how hot Jupiters form because we only just discovered them like yesterday, astronomically speaking. Like, we just figured out that they even exist, and we need some more information to try to figure out just how they form. Anyway, the very last thing before I go, say we found an Earth-like planet around another star. Could we send a probe to it? The answer is no. If you need some more elaboration, the answer is very much no. That's just it. New Horizons, for an example, New Horizons just sailed by Pluto. New Horizons is going 37,000 miles per hour. Miles. Hour. Do you think those are the right kind of units to use when we're talking about going from one star to another? No. Miles and hours just aren't going to cut it. 37,000 miles per hour, it's not going anywhere anytime soon, especially in another planet. They're just too far away. It just sucks. So that's it for today. Thanks a lot to my Patreon supporters, Helge Brokog and Tim Fever. If you'd like to help keep this show going so I can pay the bills that keep this show going and doing stuff for more spacey fun things, I should have rehearsed that, but I didn't. Go to patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, not the most recognizable name out there, but there it is, patreon.com/PM Sutter, P as in Paul, M as in Matt, Sutter as in also Sutter, PM Sutter. That's how you help me out. $1 or $2 a month. No big deal, right? It is a big deal to me. It means a lot. Thank you to everyone who supports me. Thank you for all the amazing questions. Again, Twitter and Facebook, hashtag Ask a Spaceman. You can also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, all the rest. I'm Paul Matt Sutter. That's my name. And you can also go to askaspaceman.com, ask questions there, make comments. You can also find me on YouTube. Just look up type, Ask a Spaceman. There'll be some episodes there. Thanks again to John Ziegler, Dan Cataldo, at Infirmus, at Mark Reap, and Kieran Price for all of today's questions. Thank you so much, everyone, and see you next time for more complete knowledge of time and space.